welcome to the Belt and Road podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your host, Eric Mike Sterino, coming to you today from a decent Durham, North Carolina. It's nice and sunny, a little chilly. But as always, I'm super happy to be joined by Juliet Liu in Ithaca. How's it going up there?
Hey, it's going great up here, Eric. Thanks.
Not tired of all the snow?
No, there's not enough snow.
Okay. Well, before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis, and join in on discussion on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod.
Great. So today we're going to talk about China in Latin America. China has long invested in Latin America, but its investments are diversifying and deepening in multiple respects. For one, China is branching out from a former focus on primary commodities such as soy, copper, and oil to a range of other industries, including tech and infrastructure development at various scales. But Chinese investment in Latin America and the Caribbean is also diversifying in terms of which Chinese actors are involved and what regional counterparts they're working with. China is famous worldwide for emphasizing high-level state-to-state engagements, but in the Latin America Caribbean region, Chinese actors are increasingly engaging local-level administrators and other subnational actors in what our guest today has referred to in a recent report as a multi-tiered approach. Our guest today is a very accomplished expert in China and Latin America and the Caribbean region, who we're really lucky to sit down with. Margaret Myers is the director of the Asia and Latin America program at the Inter-American Dialogue. She's established the Dialogue's China and Latin America Working Group in 2011 to examine China's growing presence in Latin America and the Caribbean. And Myers also developed the China-Latin America Financial Database, which is the only publicly available source of empirical data on Chinese state lending in Latin America, in cooperation with the Global China Initiative at Boston University's Global Development Policy Center, who we've featured a few times on this podcast. In addition to maintaining the Dialogue's China and Latin America and Meizhou Duihua blogs, Myers has testified in China-Latin America relations before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, and she actively contributes her analysis and perspective in domestic and international media, and has published numerous articles and two co-edited books on related topics. She's worked in government, private consulting, and academia, and joins us today from Washington, D.C. Margaret, welcome to the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Just to start off, tell us a bit about yourself, because you've engaged in so many different kind of facets with these topics, specifically at the Inter-American Dialogue.
Certainly. So I've had a bit of a roundabout route to where I am now at the Inter-American Dialogue. But let me just give you a quick overview of the dialogue itself and then, you know, sort of how I got there. The Inter-American Dialogue, which is a Latin America affairs think tank in Washington, D.C., has been around for about 30 years. It was started during a time of great crisis, not unlike what we're facing right now, a debt crisis. And the idea was to bring together actors from across the region to try to come up with solutions, common solutions to these shared problems. It's grown a lot. We have five program areas, and I run one of those. It's called the Asia and Latin America Program, as you mentioned, and I've been doing that for about 10 years now, sort of analyzing the relationship and watching it evolve really very rapidly over time. Before that, I worked at the Department of Defense, focusing on Latin America and on China, also creating entrepreneurial programs for the George Washington University and managing private foundations as part of a private sector firm. I was also a Chinese and Spanish teacher for Virginia public schools for a short period of time. So a number of different experiences, but each of them sort of contributing to what I'm doing now in some form or another.
Wonderful. Happy to hear you got the public educator background. My parents are both public educators, former public educators, and anyone who's within that realm or field is dear to my heart. But onto, you know, the dialogue covers not only economic issues, but also the political and cultural dimensions of China and Latin American relationship. Can you give us a bit of a context about the China-Latin American-Caribbean relationship to start out? And also, you know, what constitutes its main ties and what are the dynamics, some of the large, 10,000-foot dynamics of the relationship?
Sure. So, you know, I'm of the belief, and there's considerable debate about this among those who, you know, who consider China's global activity, but I'm of the belief that the vast majority of what China is doing in the Latin American and Caribbean region is focused on China's, you know, is based on economic objectives, focused on China's domestic reform agenda to some degree and aimed at supporting that. You know, this includes, you know, a lot of the trade relationship, which is, you know, highly focused, as was mentioned earlier, on South America's primary commodities, and also on the exportation of increasingly high value added Chinese goods, but also, you know, in support of broader food security and energy security strategies that China has developed. Certainly Latin America factors very prominently in that, within that calculus. There are numerous policies that shape China's overseas engagement in Latin America and in other regions. Some of them, like the tenets of the going out strategy, right, continue to do so in some form. And, you know, of course, the going out strategy supports the acquisition of raw materials, the development of export markets for Chinese goods, and also enabling Chinese companies, helping them to compete more effectively with their international counterparts in a wide range of industries in Latin America and other regions. And we, you know, although that particular strategy dates back to the 1990s, we still continue to see a lot of that sort of activity in Latin America and Caribbean today. China also has, you know, despite all of these economic objectives, also has a number of political objectives when engaging the region. Taiwan really stands out most prominently. The region has been a, you know, something of a battleground between, a diplomatic battleground, that is, between Taiwan and China for a number of decades now. It's still a stronghold for Taiwan, but Taiwan has been losing a number of allies in just the past few years. There's also an interest in China and among Chinese officials, right, in limiting discussion of topics deemed particularly sensitive in China. And this is done, you know, through active participation in Latin American media, but also aiming to shape some of the reporting in the region. And, you know, considerable support, I think, at this point in garnering Latin American and Caribbean support in international institutions for Chinese policy on a wide range of issues, be it, you know, internet governance, human rights, or other matters. You know, but economic interests far outweigh the political ones, you know, at this point. That said, even purely economic engagement can have major political consequences or policy-related ones at the very least. And we're certainly seeing that play out in different ways in the Latin American context.
So, Margaret, Latin America and the Caribbean are not part of the Belt and Road Initiative officially, but a great article on the Dialogues blog by you and Ricardo Barrios poses the question of whether that actually matters. So can you explain a little bit what the link is between the Belt and Road and Latin America, and does it matter and why?
Right. I mean, so this is, since we wrote that article, I can't remember when we did, maybe in 2017, like that, the Belt and Road Initiative has officially extended to the Latin American region. It did so in January 2018 when Wang Yi made a speech at the China CELAC Forum meeting in Latin America and, you know, essentially suggested that the Belt and Road Initiative had indeed been extended to the region. Mind you, this was after it had been extended to the Arctic, right? So it kind of gives you a sense of where Latin America and the Caribbean
are. Yeah, they're last in line.
Exactly, in terms of foreign policy priority for Beijing. But, you know, but nevertheless, it has been now formally extended. And there are a number of countries that have signed on, 19 so far. But I think, you know, to your point, I think the question that Ricardo and I posed when we wrote the article still stands. You know, does a formal BRI designation, does this formal extension to the region even matter when so much BRI type activity, whether we're talking about, you know, infrastructure development or trade connectivity, was already taking place, you know, either pre-2013 when the Belt and Road Initiative first emerged publicly as a conceptual framework, or certainly before the region was formally included in 2018. We've seen all of this activity. And if we think about, you know, I don't know how you all define the Belt and Road, or really, you know, there's so many varied definitions. But if we look at the Wutong, the sort of, you know, five connects, you know, that have been associated with the BRI, you know, infrastructure, investment and trade, policy coordination, financial integration, people-to-people engagement. These things, you know, have been happening in the Latin American region for a number of years. So I hardly think that the BRI extension has done much to fundamentally change the nature of all of this. It's very symbolic, you know, and important to China in that respect, indicating support for, you know, for Xi's signature foreign policy initiative. And, you know, in some cases, it's generated immediate economic returns for some of these countries that have signed Belt and Road cooperation agreements. You know, some of them, for Bolivia, for example, I believe it was Quino, you know, was allowed access to the Chinese market, or that process was sort of facilitated, the approval process for quinoa. So it's not without benefit, but it doesn't fundamentally alter the nature of the China-Latin America relationship.
Yeah, we certainly, I think our whole podcast is dedicated to how do you define the Belt and Road? And we try to do it by featuring really wonderful grounded research like yours and an excellent new report that was just published in December called Going Local, an assessment of China's administrative level activity in Latin America and the Caribbean. And absolutely loved it. It was one of my few must-read reports from last year on Belt and Road related topics. So I highly, highly recommend everyone to read it. The central focus of the report is China's shift towards a multi-tier approach to engagement with the region. So first, can you define what you mean by this multi-tiered approach? And what was the approach before? Has this been a shift to a multi-tier approach? Has this always been one? And is this something Latin American Caribbean specific?
Well, thank you so much, Eric, for talking about the report. It's been a labor of love for the past few months. And so I'm really grateful that it's out and that you enjoyed reading it. So yeah, with respect to this multi-tiered approach, a little bit of background. You know, China relied very heavily at the onset of its engagement with Latin America back in the mid-1990s and early 2000s on often sort of personality-driven relationships with Latin American heads of state. And one of my favorite stories is, you know, that of a prominent Chinese official going to Cuba to talk to Fidel Castro at the time to get recommendations about how to engage more extensively with Latin America. And Castro's recommendation was to, you know, to first head to Venezuela and to speak with then President Hugo Chavez to try to get some deals going, especially in the oil sector. That's not panned out particularly well, I don't think, for China, but nevertheless, it demonstrates sort of how things were done at the beginning. And so China focused much of its initial diplomatic attention on the cultivation of bilateral relationships that were, you know, in many ways based on these friendships with a specific subset of Latin American leaders. And this was, you know, initially effective in creating opportunities for Chinese companies in a very new region from China, and in fact, the most distant region from China. But over time, China has sought to expand and diversify opportunities for Chinese companies while also reducing their risk profile. And they've noted that these personality-driven relationships, whether they have been in Ecuador or in Argentina under Cristina Kirchner or in Venezuela, you know, have tended to be somewhat higher risk and not always resulting in sort of the most optimal outcomes. And so China's approach to engagement with the region, including in the diplomatic realm, has become more sophisticated and multifaceted as a result of this realization. And so I use the term multi-tiered engagement in the report to describe this more sophisticated and wide-ranging approach that China has adopted, wherein it engages, you know, at different levels of government across the region. So this includes a continued and extensive focus on cultivating bilateral relationships, but also a focus at the regional level through mostly formal platforms such as the China CELAC Forum, which I referenced earlier, and increasingly, and this is very important, activity at the subnational level, developing ties to individual provinces or states, or with cities really of all sizes, you know, from capital cities to those with populations of 200,000 or even less. And this is seen as, you know, simply a way to ensure that there is to cultivate an external environment that is, you know, conducive to more in the way of Chinese engagement, whether in the commercial realm or the political one.
That's great. These local level engagements I find really fascinating, especially in the way that you write about them. Can you give us a sense of what the local level looks like in the region and kind of what prompted this approach? I mean, this shift from kind of personality driven engagements is really fascinating. So what does the local level hold, and how did Chinese investors and various Chinese actors kind of decide to shift their approach or their rationale as to how they engage?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. First of all, I think this stems from sort of a very sort of opportunistic approach that we've seen China take, you know, across the region. And not just opportunistic, but also flexible. And this has been evident, you know, for over a decade now, wherein, you know, China adapts its strategy in different countries and different investment environments to achieve whatever outcomes it's pursuing. So it will engage very differently in places like Venezuela, where things are, you know, it's more of a sort of authoritarian government. Things are very top down. Decision making is very top down. Negotiation is directly with Maduro in the case of Venezuela. And the same for other countries where there's a similar sort of top down structure. But in other countries that are more open, that have more sort of competitive procurement processes and open tenders and rely on competitive bids for major infrastructure projects, Chinese companies engage very differently. And the same, you know, the same rationale can be applied to this sort of multi-tiered engagement process, right? This multi-tiered phenomenon wherein, you know, some objectives are best achieved through multilateral fora, at the very least sort of communication of China's foreign policy, top foreign policy interests and objectives and policy toward Latin America specifically. At the bilateral level, you know, this is still, it's still exceedingly important in terms of deal making, right? At ensuring a strong and productive relationship. But, you know, a lot of the commercial deal making can actually be made and may even be made more quickly at the local level, especially for companies like tech firms, Huawei, ZTE, that are in fact developing technologies that are for cities, right? A lot of these safe cities technologies that we see being developed, a lot of the surveillance tech is in fact intended to be used in cities. So in many cases, it makes sense simply to market these things directly to those who would be using them while still trying to engage with many of the institutions, the Interior Ministry and others, right? Who would be responsible for regulating them or else approving certain deals. So it's not as though it's one, you know, one level or another, but rather a sort of ad hoc approach wherein you may engage at different levels to achieve different objectives. At the local level, we see, you know, really a wide range of Chinese actors active. These include central government entities, you know, and by extension, of course, the embassy officials, provincial government authorities are really quite active in certain cases. So it's not just Chinese central government activity, but also, you know, delegations from a wide range of different provinces. Quasi-governmental organizations, these include things, you know, like the Chinese Council for the Promotion of International Trade, CCPIT, the Chinese People's Association for Friendship with Foreign Countries, which does a lot of the sister cities work, which has also been very facilitating of local level engagement. Companies do this, right? They have their networks of contacts at the local level. Universities have important networks that often facilitate deal making. Overseas Chinese communities, there's been extensive effort to cultivate, you know, overseas Chinese communities to ensure their support, first of all, for China's for the One China policy. And to help them to, you know, potentially facilitate some deal making. And then, you know, others, there are many others that we see active at this level. So it's really exceedingly wide ranging, the extent of activity. Although some of these actors have a more prominent role at the local level than others. Why are they doing this? I think there are a range of objectives that Chinese, you know, entities that are engaging at the local level are trying to achieve, you know, and we've already talked about deal making, right? Creating more space for Chinese companies in, you know, diverse investment environments in Latin America and the Caribbean. And it's easier, I think, to engage often at the local level where you can really get a sense of sort of the political economy aspects that you're dealing with, but also advancing China's policy interests at various levels of government and society, as I mentioned, whether it's on internet governance, data privacy, human rights, Taiwan, you name it. And then also just broadly shaping views of China throughout the Latin American region. And so much of what we're seeing done, you know, just kind of sets the groundwork. There's not an immediate objective evident in all of these cases, right? A very clear deal that's on the horizon. It's rather cultivating these relationships in anticipation of a potential opportunity forthcoming.
Yeah, very interesting. And I think, the answer just might answer a little bit of what I'm about to ask. But, you know, your report notes about, you know, this multi-tier engagement that you see in different levels, that there's, you know, autonomy exercised by these different actors involved, from the state-owned enterprises to the Chinese state. But then there's the federal state, but there's also provincial governments that have their own foreign delegations. So can you talk about these different levels of effectiveness in their negotiations and different outcomes as a result? I know you had two different case studies in your report, if you can talk about those a little bit.
Yeah. So, I think this is a really important point. A lot of these actors, it seems at least, you know, have been told to go forth, right? Maybe as part of the Belt and Road Initiative or through some other framework to make deals or to engage in various other ways, but are broadly, you know, are generally speaking sort of allowed some flexibility and autonomy in determining how best to do that and with whom to engage at the local level, that includes state or provincial level, or even at the central government level. And so that results, I think, in considerable variation in outcomes, right, in certain instances. So the two case studies that we profiled in the report, one was on Coquimbo, Chile, right, where it's one that dates back over a decade. It's a relationship where we've seen, you know, a lot of interaction between Chinese, I believe it's Henan and Coquimbo for over 10 years. And another is the Jujuy province in Argentina, where there's been extensive activity in just really the past 5 years. A lot of that motivated by the governor of Jujuy, Geraldo Morales, who has been, you know, very supportive of Chinese engagement in really a wide variety of sectors. So, you know, solar energy, lithium exploration and extraction, big data services, educational exchange, you name it. There's a lot of activity happening in Jujuy right now due to a wide range of different factors, frankly. The effectiveness of, and I mean, so these are very different case studies, wherein you have one where it's, you know, been going on for a long time, but there's not a lot of concrete evidence of actual deal-making or outcomes. And then another, Jujuy, where it's not, you know, it's only been about 5 years where we've seen a lot of this local engagement, and yet it's been an exceedingly productive relationship for China and, you know, potentially also for Jujuy in certain instances. I think, you know, Jujuy officials judge it to have been a very wise decision indeed. But, you know, the effectiveness of these partnerships depends on a lot of different variables, right? First of all, as I said, you know, in the case of Jujuy, local government buy-in, right? Geraldo Morales was really integral in making a lot of that local level engagement happen. So it's not just China coming in and introducing itself. A lot of this relies also on the governments being supportive of the idea, right? Also, local level decision-making authority. A lot depends on the sort of governance structure of these countries. More federalized governance systems, there tends to be, frankly, by among Chinese entities and companies, more of a focus on countries where there is this federalized system of governance, federal system. So, you know, Argentina is one prominent example, and there's a lot of activity there. Brazil is another, Chile to a degree. And so at the provincial or state level, even municipal level, a lot of these, you know, leaders have a considerable authority over deal making and over their own budgets, depending upon whatever sort of system is in place. In other cases, they have very limited decision making authority. And so in those cases, maybe it makes less sense to engage at the local level or to engage at least in deal making at the local level. Availability of financing, right? Some of these local level governments are prepared to provide financing for certain projects. In other cases, they require, 85% financing from Exim Bank, for example, which is the case of for the Caltrate project in solar project in Jujuy province in Argentina. Local support for a project. Some of these projects are opposed by not the governments necessarily in these localities, but by local communities. And that has, derailed a number of projects in Latin America. And then, what sort of Chinese organization is engaging, right? Some effects are more immediate than others. If it's a company, obviously they're looking to strike a specific deal to market certain technologies, to sell certain equipment. But in other cases, the CPA FFC, which is responsible for sister cities development, is just looking, broadly speaking, to cultivate, some sort of diplomatic relationship at the local level, which may eventually be conducive to deal making, but that's not the primary goal at the onset of the work. It's really, the outcomes depend on so very many different variables.
Yeah, I think that this is not exactly what we had written as a prepared question, but I know it's hard to make conclusions across such a diverse region and obviously even more so across the world. But one thing I just loved that your report made me kind of reflect on was that, I've asked before just like what things are instances of China learning and changing and adjusting to the regional conditions, and what things are China making a concerted kind of like larger scale shift in strategy. And I think, the way that you kind of weave things together in this report, it seems like there's this multiple kind of back and forth, China realizing shifts that it has to make in terms of the way Latin American politics work and deal making, mm-hmm. as well as it just becoming, as it becomes more and more involved in the region, it just seems like you're saying that it's also kind of natural to progress down to those more local levels. I don't know if you think that reading is, there's like these multiple threads that I'm seeing, but I really liked that about the way that your report presented things.
No, I completely agree. I think, this is, as I said before, very reflective of just the amount of flexibility that we see sort of exhibited by, Chinese government entities, right? But also Chinese companies as they try to engage the region. And I think I pointed out in the report, that in the case of Argentina, there's a lot of opportunism at play, right? And so with Cristina Kirchner in office a number of years ago, Chinese companies really found themselves in a position to strike a lot of public works deals. And they did so effectively. They were approved, and even some of the legislation was changed to enable them to engage more extensively. But they found, once Cristina Kirchner exited office and Mauricio Macri entered, that a lot of the deals that they had negotiated with the previous administration were in jeopardy. And that because Argentina sort of holds all tax revenue at the central level and distributes it as it sees fit, even the financing for some of these projects, which were, needed to go to various provinces, was being held back. And so it was a year before Gajoba, Chinese construction firm Gajoba, which was responsible for a couple of dam projects in Santa Cruz province, could even pay its staff. And so this, was a huge problem. So what was the solution? The solution was to engage instead at the provincial level. And, one example that I provided with Jujuy province. And in fact, the financing that they distributed to Jujuy province for the Caltrate solar project was directly to the province rather than to the central government to avoid, these problems that they'd already experienced. So that is very clearly indicative of a learning process on the part of Chinese banks and Chinese companies as they navigate this exceedingly complex, political economic landscape.
Yeah. The emphasis on flexibility is fascinating and learning. And in the end, in the end of the report, you conclude that there's ambiguity as to the effects of the local level engagements, right? It's hard. These are all moving targets, of course, but it's always hard to kind of figure out how successful are these approaches, and give us a sense of kind of what factors you look at when you're assessing the effects of these subnational engagements in Latin America. And what do you think the future holds? Do you think that this trajectory will continue?
Like I said, I think there are so many variables that will determine just how effective a lot of this outreach is. And in fact, some of it is intended to address already problematic situations. So for example, I think a lot of the sort of efforts to connect with overseas Chinese communities in Mexico are based on an existing very tense relationship with Mexico based on trade competition in domestic and third markets. So, you know, I think the objectives vary, you know, the conditions vary. And so it's really hard to predict what will happen and what will not in specific instances. That said, what we are seeing is just so much activity, right? Far more diplomatic and quasi-diplomatic activity coming from China in a not, you know, fully coordinated way, but with similar broad objectives in mind. That, you know, so much of what the U.S. and other countries are doing really pales in comparison. So even if some things don't work out, just based on the scale of all of this, my sense is that China will effectively move the needle in its favor in at least some critical areas. And it appears that, you know, a lot of the local level activity that we're seeing there, there's quite a bit of mining company involvement. There's quite a bit of infrastructure company involvement, but a lot of tech company involvement. And so in those areas in particular, I think we may see some real advances already are, right? But this activity, I think, will promote even more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always so interesting throughout. There seems to be a pattern. I don't know if you would agree with the pattern in Latin American Caribbean of, you know, there was state-state relations, and then on an infrastructure ground or major foreign aid project ground, Chinese state-owned enterprises get brought into the country. And then they find other business opportunities kind of autonomously on their own. I'm trying to think of what my question is to this, other than the fact of just like, do you have numbers of the amount, like let's stick with the infrastructure sector in South America, of like the amount of Chinese state-owned enterprises that are involved and like, and also the dynamics of inter-Chinese state-owned enterprise competition within the Latin American Caribbean markets?
Yeah, I mean, there are numerous state-owned enterprises active, construction companies in particular, and then subcontractors, of course, of construction companies. Really, all of the top, you know, the top firms, Czech, CCCC, you know, you name it, are Sino, Hydro, Gajoba. I mean, all of them are China Railway are evident in some form or another, and usually in numerous different countries doing all sorts of different projects. I don't have any numbers. I know we've tracked Chinese transport infrastructure engagement and found, you know, Chinese involvement and indicated interest between, I believe it was 2013, or rather 2010 and 2018 in 150 different just simply transport infrastructure projects across Latin America and the Caribbean. But yes, I mean, the point you bring up about competition among these state-owned enterprises is a really important one. It's one that doesn't really receive a lot of attention. There's a sense, I think, or an expectation that Chinese companies simply come in, that they're directed by the Chinese state, and therefore will be the ones to secure certain deals. But that is not the case. And, you know, some of the most sort of illustrative examples of the extent of competition, I think, are often come out of Brazil, where so many countries are indeed interested in investing. It's such a large market, right? There are a lot of opportunities there. Many are already well established. And, you know, a lot of competition for certain acquisitions and also for greenfield projects among mostly construction firms. Also, I mean, to a degree, well, actually, you know, with respect to hydropower and some energy investments, it's, I've heard at the very least, you know, that there's quite a bit of competition between Sinohydro and Gajoba, with Sinohydro being sort of the dominant actor in the Latin American region. But in other instances, you know, State Grid Brazil has really established a rather dominant presence in distribution of electricity, as has China Three Gorges. Those two companies really dominate that space and have tended to focus their activity in Brazil, in Peru for China Three Gorges and its subsidiaries, as well as in a handful of other countries in the region.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
Yeah, and And so moving to just some other topics that you've written on before, specifically the idea of Chinese finance in Latin American Caribbean, you know, first, there's this, lots of the financing was overwhelmingly to infrastructure development and China as a major lender within that, within the region. You know, this report was in 2018. Do you have any major updates or shifts that you've seen since this 2018 report? You know, there was the broader Boston University of, report that some data had a little bit of controversy in because it, you know, only had the policy bank, which I think was fine in terms of, because that's what his methodology, that's what it was looking into. But yeah. Has there been this, that same shift that's been seen in other Belt and Road countries where it's moved away from the 85% XM loans to more, you know, build, operate, and transfer with Chinese state commercial banks, or to a straight up, you know, merger and acquisitions from these Chinese state or quasi-state entities?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real mix, you know. So what we found, and we put out one of these reports year annually. So we had a 2019 one, and we're going to publish the 2021 in February. And what we found really is that, you know, and we work with, you know, Boston University on this too, and we do only look at least in this particular report, at the policy banks, because those have been sort of the most critical actors in the Latin American and Caribbean region up to now, right? Let me preface that. So in any case, we found that for the past 6 years, there has been a really precipitous decline in Chinese policy bank finance to the region, to the point where, you know, last year we saw just 1.1 billion. You can compare that to 35 billion in 2010. And this year, we may have zero. There has been some finance evidently promised to Ecuador in the amount of $2.4 billion in 2020, but it does not appear as though that particular deal has yet been signed. So it may very well be that this decline, you know, continues in 2020, and we'll see what happens in 2021. But yeah, policy banks have all but exited, you know, the region in terms of providing new loans. They have restructured some of the finance in amid COVID-19 in Ecuador, a couple of tranches of debt there, and also one tranche of debt in Venezuela, but have not excused anything or any of this debt at this point in time. So, I mean, that's the sort of policy bank story. On the other hand, we're seeing more activity from the commercial banks, you know, kind of as you alluded to, especially ICBC, which, you know, frankly, in some ways acts as a policy bank broadly, you know, in support and in collaboration with policy banks in support of Chinese government objectives. Bank of China, too, and a few others. Most of what we see these commercial banks doing is in, you know, in mining in the case of ICBC, but for all of the others in the area of green energy, of renewable energy. So much of what they are doing in terms of sort of project finance loans to either Latin American companies or Chinese companies to do this work. So, you know, there is still plenty of finance going for Chinese finance going for projects, but not nearly at the same scale as we saw in the past. At the same time, we see Chinese companies themselves, you know, engaging in public-private partnerships, you know, through open tenders, sometimes coming with their own finance, which may very well be from the policy banks, you know, sort of internally. But nevertheless, they are officially providing it. Some of these companies have their own financial arms, which do much of this financing work. And so, I mean, there are numerous ways in which Chinese companies are engaging in these projects through different, you know, financial mechanisms. And there is a really remarkable diversification in that particular respect. And we've seen that happening for the past 3 or 4 years now.
And so some of those are kind of longer term trends that you're talking about. Has anything major changed since COVID? I mean, in the last year, do you see, is Latin America a piece of this evolving story where Chinese financial kind of lending is slowing down under the kind of global impacts of COVID?
You know, I think, yes, we've had, as far as I understand it, 2020 was a very low year. We saw quite a bit of activity at the beginning of 2020, but it's slowed considerably really since around March, especially foreign direct investment. Trade continues to boom, of course, but FDI has slowed. And, you know, unsurprisingly, in fact, a number of employees from some of these companies went home for extended period right. of time. Many are back now. And so I think a lot of this activity will resume. It's just a matter of when. There are, you know, many who are predicting that Chinese companies in particular will be in a very good position to seize ailing assets in various, you know, strategic sectors in the Latin American region, you know, especially in electricity generation and distribution. Perhaps in mining and a few other, you know, sectors where China has already a considerable presence. But yeah, I mean, there also, I mean, but I think we also need to keep in mind, and few people talk about this, the sort of limitations on Chinese banks and Chinese companies, right? China's domestic economy has recovered well, but continues to face a lot of problems, debt-related issues, employment-related issues, you name it. And so, you know, Chinese company or China is not economically speaking, in the same place it is now as it was post the global financial crisis, right? When we saw right. a lot of acquisitions, a surge in mergers and acquisitions in the region on the part of Chinese companies. So will we see more activity in certain sectors? Yes, I think so. But I think it will be a bit more limited than many are expecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. Those few points are really helpful. It's been so hard for me to keep up with the kind of overdramatic readings of like Chinese lending is dropping off. COVID has killed the Belt and Road and the right. much more level-headed things. I think you bringing up specific, you know, sectoral kind of shifts and which things are affected and which things aren't is much more helpful than that. Okay. So I think the last question we had, it seems to be actually something of your wheelhouse and just in terms of, you know, what does China's relationship with Latin America mean for the U.S.? And as China becomes more and more involved in the region, you know, how have we seen American political leaders react and how do they read China's presence? And I would love your just hot take on what China's growing relationship in the region means for U.S. relations.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll just preface this by saying that the Trump administration obviously has, you know, focused most extensively on China's global role, right? And on China's role in Latin America and the Caribbean by extension. But this has been something that I think has been of concern to the U.S. for at least a couple of other presidencies, right? We saw mention of this during the George W. Bush administration. We saw mention of this during the Obama administration. You know, through research, through hearings, you know, there was evidence of some concern, especially around investment in the Panama Canal and things like that, or a partnership with Venezuela and Cuba. So it's not a new issue, right? It's just that Trump has really, you know, elevated the perceived threat. And, you know, my sense is that, and there is, I mean, there are a lot of, I think, concerns, justifiable concerns for the U.S., especially as it relates to sort of competition in various key strategic sectors, you know, be it technology or otherwise. A lot of U.S. companies and European companies, for that matter, are very much struggling to compete with China in certain areas. And others, you know, U.S. insurance companies are not finding Chinese insurance companies to be major competitors at this phase. China's far behind in that sense, but is rapidly catching up in a lot of areas that I think have taken the U.S. by surprise. And so, you know, that's certainly a concern among those in the defense community. There's also a lot of concern about sort of the nature of some of these investments and why China is pursuing what appear to be non-commercially viable investments in things like ports and whether ports have dual use, you know, capacity, both, you know, civilian and military use capacity, and whether that in fact is some sort of preparation for an eventual military contingency with the United States. And so, you know, the concerns are frankly wide ranging. If you talk to environmentalists, of course, they have a much different set of concerns. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm of the belief there are sort of two beliefs as Biden administration comes in, or lines of thinking about, you know, how the Biden administration coming into power might have an effect on all of this. One is that it'll make things harder for China in Latin America, simply because, you know, so much of China's policy, so much of China's messaging in Latin America was largely based on things that the Trump administration rejected: multilateralism, global trade, you know, climate change. And so it was very easy for China to position itself as a champion of and leader in advancing all of those areas and to work with Latin America based on that sort of framework. Will it be able to do so as easily if the Biden administration reengages in all of these ways? Maybe not. The other is that, you know, China will perceive Biden as not being as tough on China as Trump, and that will, you know, encourage China to engage even more extensively in certain sectors and to believe that it can do so without recourse. And so, you know, it remains to be seen, really. Much is based on China's own interpretations of all of this and some of the right. initial sort of policies yeah, that Biden implements vis-a-vis China. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm mistaken, it's Brazil that has one of the interesting case examples, along with like Romanian nuclear and LNG and Mozambique and a few others, where the new U.S. International Development Finance Corporation put in a huge loan for the 5G network if they didn't take Huawei. Am I right or wrong on that? Just mm-hmm. but in just that idea of the U.S. kind of competing on this type of approach are competing with China in third countries.
Right. Yeah. And the Development Finance Corporation was very much set up to be able to compete more effectively and to bring, you know, U.S. private sector resources to bear in development projects across the region, especially in those countries that are of, you know, very important strategic and political interest to the United States. So yes, I mean, and that is one example of the way in which some of these funds have been used is, you know, to try to limit Chinese competition in the area of 5G in particular in Brazil. Although it's unclear, you know, at this point, what Brazil will do, whether it will, in fact, you know, ban Huawei from participating in the upcoming auction, or whether it will follow the advice of Brazilian internet service providers and, you know, and include the Huawei. And there's a lot of support for including domestically, right, for including Huawei in these auctions. And of course, so much depends also on, you know, the incoming Biden administration and the stance that it takes. There's a sense that, you know, Biden will take a much stronger stance on the Amazon and that Bolsonaro, President Bolsonaro of Brazil, will use 5G as something of a bargaining chip to try to ensure that the U.S. doesn't put too much pressure on Brazil and protects Brazil's Amazon-related sovereignty, as they call it.
All of this is so fascinating, and the complications that you bring up make me more and more convinced that if we could ban the phrase tough on China then from like all politics, because it doesn't mean anything to me. Just even the complexities in the example of Huawei and the negotiations across countries that you're bringing up, it just seems such a useless way of framing geopolitics.
Right. I think we need to reconsider a lot of the phrasing and the strategic communication, you know, especially as we make these points to the Latin American region and other, you know, allies.
Right. Great.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation, Margaret. We stick around for recommendations.
Sure.
Great. You've been listening to the Belt and Road Podcast. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. Margaret, do you have any recommendations for our listeners today of something you've really enjoyed reading, watching, listening to lately?
Sure. Yeah. So I think, mine are all going to be so pitiful. I have 3-year-old twins, and so everything that I watch tends to be...
That'll be great.
Paw Patrol.
Paw Patrol is a great one. It really teaches you a lot about international relations. Yeah. I think, what have I loved so much of late? I've been having dreams, I think, like a lot of us, about, you know, being in open countryside and, and trying to escape the craziness that is COVID. So in any case, we've been watching Yellowstone, which I enjoy despite, you know, not typically loving Kevin Costner as an actor for all of these years, but the landscape is gorgeous. The storyline is a little bit stressful, but I certainly recommend that to any of your readers. And my reading these days has been so Incredibly boring, I think, for most, but I've been reading a lot on infrastructure finance. And if you want a sort of primer, you know, just in preparation for trying to understand, you know, as we talked about, some of the different ways that China's approaching this. But there's a book by Neil Grigg that is just simply a great primer in terms of, you know, how to understand the different approaches and to achieve best outcomes, including in the environmental space. So that's one that I recommend for those who are.
What's the title of his book?
It's called Infrastructure Finance, The Business of Infrastructure for a Sustainable Future.
Awesome.
And it's not a new one, but it's a one.
You know,
one
our listenership, that's kind of a key, that's a key target book. It won't bore any of our listeners.
Not at all.
yeah, I'm giddy hearing about that recommendation. Thanks for that one. Juliet, you got any recommendations?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I engage on and off with Twitter only, but sometimes I just need non-actual serious Twitter. And I've been following the Yongle Emperor at Imperial_Yongle and Chongzhen Emperor at Chongzhen EMP. And they're just really sardonic accounts that comment on like everything China relevant, but also totally irrelevant. And it's they're just kind of fun and silly to follow. But on a much more serious note, much more serious, there is also a really good article that came out, I think, a couple months ago. It came out in the journal Gender, Place, and Culture. It's a article called We Too, Contending with the Sexual Politics of Fieldwork in China. And this is written by three white women who are based in North America and European universities, three that I admire in the China field, Mindy Schneider, Elizabeth Lord, and Jessica Wilczek. But they call for more frank discussions of sexual politics in field-based research, and they draw on a lot of China-specific research that they've done, especially ethnography and just situations where sexual politics are really important to how you kind of collect data on the ground. And they talk about the issues of valorizing kind of a heroic approach to field work and then the ways to break that down in senses that will help early career researchers kind of navigate the difficult questions that come up in field research when you're trying to get information out of people and build rapport, and also working in countries like China where men and women have very different roles in society. So, you know, one recommendation with some levity and one with a lot of seriousness. So there we go. Eric, what do you want us to check out?
Yeah, no, that sounds like a really important article, and I want to read that. So I have two recommendations. First, our old friends at PandaPod Dragonclaw just found out that they have a newsletter now, PandaPod Dragonclaw. It's a blog that has some of the best original in-depth work on Chinese global engagement. And there, as everyone has a newsletter now, their newsletter is one you should actually subscribe to. And they, on each newsletter, they focus on a specific Belt and Road project and go in depth into it. And so that's very useful. And second is The Mandalorian. I am not a science fiction or fantasy person much at all. I'm agnostic towards Star Wars and Trek and Lord of the Rings. All of those, they're fun enough to watch, but I don't really care. But Mandalorian, I somehow watched it, and it's the first time I've ever been like a real fan of it. Like a new monster or something comes up, and I'm like, whoa, what is that? And like a new weapon. I don't know why it's different, but it's just so much cooler and better, and there's Baby Yoda, and he's so cute.
Oh my god, those are fighting words, Eric. We're gonna get so much feedback.
Yeah, I guess I'll know if there's actually anyone listening to the show.
I don't love Star Wars. I don't watch much, but I love The Mandalorian.
Oh yeah, The Mandalorian is the best Star Wars that's ever been created.
So, yeah, good luck with
throw that hot take out there.
Yeah.
Well, Margaret, as this conversation descends into reality,
sci-fi debates.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
Really great work, Margaret. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.